Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Jeremy David Schnittman is a research astrophysicist at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, where he's focused on theoretical and computational models of black hole accretion flows, ray polarimetry, Jeremy, dark matter annihilation. He's been described as a general purpose astrophysics theorist. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks, George.
Excited to have you on the show. Tell us a little bit about your personal lives, more about your work, and why you do what you do.
Sure. So, as you said, I'm a theoretical astrophysicist. Usually the first question is just what the heck is that? So a theoretical astrophysicist is somebody who uses physics to study astronomy, to study the stuff in the sky. So not to make any comparisons, but the first astrophysicist was Isaac Newton. Everybody knows the famous story. He saw an apple fall and kind of realized that's how gravity works. So what Newton was doing there was he was taking the laws of physics as we understand on Earth by seeing how an apple falls and how gravity works, and then applies it to things in space. How does the moon go around the Earth? How does the Earth go around the sun? Which was, you know, just incredible. It was an incredible breakthrough at the time to realize that we can understand the universe just by staying right here on Earth and doing experiments in the laboratory, et cetera. Of course, it's the more you can measure and observe the stars and the galaxies and the asteroids, all that stuff, it helps you, but still ultimately you're basing everything you understand and everything you know based on physics that we learn on Earth. So that's what an astrophysicist is. Isaac Newton is an astrophysicist. A theoretical astrophysicist, which Isaac Newton was also for the most part, is somebody who does, again, mostly theoretical work, does equations, pencil, paper, computer simulations, that sort of thing, as opposed to using a telescope, right? I maybe once used a telescope. I don't use the Hubble Space Telescope. I don't use the James Webb Space Telescope, but I work with people who do. So they use those telescopes, they get the data, they measure distances, temperatures, velocities, all the things that we need to know about what is going on in outer space. And then I try to understand why it's going on. So I'm trying to figure out the kind of the why and what ifs of astrophysics and astronomy. And so that's all right. So that's what a theoretical astrophysicist is. And then more specifically, I mostly work on questions about black holes, in gravitational waves, X-rays, accretion disks, that sort of thing. Those are all more or less have to do with black holes. Black holes is really my lane. They're just really cool, fascinating things that I'm really blessed that I'm able to, you know, to do that for a living.
Very cool. So you are trying to figure out the whys and the what ifs. Are you concerned that you're never going to answer those questions? And how do you know that you've done a good job today?
Yeah, right. I had a famous astrophysicist once said he had a great line. He said that an observer, i.e. like an experimentalist, you know, our version of an experimentalist has to be right every time, right? They can't, you know, make mistakes when they do measurements, but a theorist only has to be right once. You have to make one prediction that comes true and you basically make a name for yourself. So, you know, over the course of about 20 years in the field so far, I've made a handful of, I think, interesting predictions, none of which have yet quite been proven, but I don't think they've been proven wrong yet either. So it'll, you know, I'll certainly know that I had had a good day and that I did a good job when one of those predictions comes true. So I'll give you a quick example of one that we think might actually be proven either right or wrong very soon. It's with, we made a prediction about 10 years ago about how X-rays should look from black holes, right? You have gas that orbits around a black hole. It gets very hot. It shines off the X-rays. Now, that's been known for 50 years. The detail that we said is that the polarization, kind of which way the light is angled, just like your polarized sunglasses kind of can help protect glare from light shining off of the road or from the water, whatever. X-rays that are shining off of the gas from a black hole are going to be kind of polarized in a certain way. So we made a prediction of how those X-rays are going to be polarized. It's a very difficult measurement to make, though. In fact, they just last year launched a new satellite from NASA that can really for the first time measure that polarization, that property of X-rays from black holes. And they've now looked at a few black holes that should be exhibiting this property. And now we just have to kind of sort through the data and understand whether or not the prediction is proven. So that's exciting. That'd be a good day.
Yeah, fascinating. So we talked about Newton. The apple falls from the tree. He then observes his observable environment and makes assumptions about what then the whole space and the galaxies and the universes are like. Do you, as you are doing your work, how worried are you or how thoughtful are you about your assumptions and assumptions of the past and what you're bringing with you and looking at new data?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's, you know, in the hundreds of years since Newton, it gets, you know, kind of getting harder and harder to really anchor those understandings. We can't make a black hole in the lab, at least not yet. So we have to rely a lot on our math and our confidence that the math is right. So this is something that really the next generation after Newton, which is Einstein, Albert Einstein, really pioneered this approach. And, you know, intellectually, he's absolutely my role model of how to go about these sort of questions. So he starts off with kind of some basic physics intuition, like nothing goes faster than the speed of light. And then he just starts asking questions like, in fact, my 10-year-old son, when he was riding in the car with a bunch of his friends, you know, literally asked this question, you know, what happens when you're in the Millennium Falcon and you fire your laser guns and you're going the speed of light? Like, don't you crash into it? I almost drove off the road. I was like, that's such a good question, guys. Let me tell you all about it. You know, because this is essentially what Einstein was asking. He started with this very simple assumption that you can't go faster than the speed of light, and that light always goes exactly the speed of light. And then he kind of took it where it went. You know, well, what happens if this happens? And what happens if you do this? And what happens if you have someone going the other way and shooting a laser the other way? And he got to the point where the only way to really answer these questions was through equations and math, because we couldn't do experiments. But then in the 100 years since Einstein made a lot of those predictions and derived a lot of those formulas, bit by bit, we actually are able to test a lot of those things. We are able to test a lot of his predictions from relativity. And, you know, it's amazing. 100 years later, he's still got a perfect record. You know, every single one of those predictions from relativity has come true. So, you know, if somebody's equation predicts A, B, and C, and I can go out and measure A and B, and they're right, then I'm, you know, fairly certain that C is going to be right, even if we can't measure it. So that's really the faith that we've got built up in these equations. Because everywhere we look where they do apply and we can measure them, they work.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Fascinating. Can we actually see black holes, or are we making assumptions and inferences as to what they look like?
Yeah. So a pure black hole is black. You really wouldn't be able to see it. It would, you know, really would be black. Fortunately, nothing else in the universe is black. So even if you had a black hole, there's enough kind of background light behind it that you'd see a shadow. So you actually would, you know, are you seeing the shadow or are you seeing the light? I don't know. That's a little too esoteric, but you would see that something's there. Just like, I guess, in real life, do you see the shadow or do you see the light? I don't know. But even more so, a lot of times we see the gas or stars or planets that are moving around the black hole. So we see very, very strong evidence that there is something there, that there's something that's moving the gas or moving the stars around it, and oftentimes moving them at prodigious speeds, which could really only be accomplished by something as powerful as a black hole.
Do you ever get stumped, or are you always sort of stumped?
Oh my gosh, all the time. Computers. Every time I have to install a new program or run a new app on a computer, I get stumped. Even though I spend literally all day in front of a computer writing computer programs, doing computer simulations, it's still, you know, it's hard, right? You know, the libraries aren't in the right place. The directories aren't working. This is the kind of thing that I struggle with every day.
Yeah, I appreciate that. In terms of, for lack of a better term, your professional work, when you're looking at something, how often are you ideating with other astrophysicists or other people?
Yeah. A lot. I would say in the grand scheme of things, like across the whole field, I'm definitely more towards the end of the solo practitioner. But even so, most of my papers are in collaboration with at least a couple other people. I do like to just talk ideas, bounce them off the walls. Today I'm at my home office, but when I'm in work at the Goddard Space Flight Center, you know, all the offices are open and people just go up and down the halls, bouncing ideas off of the chalkboard, which is really, really a fruitful endeavor. So we have to talk to each other, or else we'd just be in a vacuum, an unintentional vacuum.
Sure. How often do you literally just stare off into space? I know that you said that you don't look through telescopes, but just give yourself kind of blank time to think about things.
Yeah. Well, in terms of really staring off into space for thinking about things, that's a lot when just, you know, trying to fall asleep at night. These are the ideas that are bouncing around my head. Even sometimes waking up in the middle of the night, I'll be thinking about a physics problem. Staring off into literal space, also, whenever I get the chance. I mean, the last few mornings, go out early in the morning, it's still dark out. I see the crescent moon, you know, just above the horizon. It's, you know, it's not my research, but it's still a big part of my life. And it's exciting, and it's always interesting and inspirational when you see those things in the sky.
For sure. Do you think it's we're all different and our perspectives are different, and we've got liberals and we've got conservatives, and there's probably equivalents to that in your world. So it is, I was just curious, I guess my question is, how cooperative are you? I know we talked about ideating and sharing ideas with people, but just in maybe the field in general, how cooperative are you with other people that are outside of your maybe laboratory?
Yeah, we certainly have a lot of collaborations with other institutions, a lot of universities. You know, we work for the government, but, you know, it very much is an academic setting. But then within the academic world, as you probably know, there are, you know, old rivalries and nemeses, and, you know, there's the guy that, you know, said my paper was wrong 50 years ago, and every time I see him at a conference, I'm gonna, you know, walk away. So there is a little bit of that kind of, you know, I would call childish behavior. But for the most part, you know, that's what's great about science is, especially in a place like astrophysics, where at least for now it's really not very politically charged, there really is a pretty good consensus when something is right and something is wrong, or when something is still kind of up for grabs. And if two people disagree on the interpretation of a certain observation or prediction, they may disagree on it now, but they will almost always agree that, like, yes, if we could do this one other measurement, that would solve the question. And that's actually a really nice feeling, because that tells you that you're not necessarily stuck in a lifetime argument, right? We're just stuck in a certain temporary state of confusion, and we know basically what to do to get out of that state. So that's, you know, I really appreciate that, because that's a luxury that really most people don't have, you know, in terms of whatever moral or philosophical quandaries.
What do you think makes for a good astrophysicist?
Number one, curiosity. That's something that I think everyone really starts off with, and it's just a question of whether it gets beaten out of them or whether they can nurture it long enough to, you know, let it be, you know, survive any sort of cynicism that the world throws at it. So that's one of the reasons one of my favorite audiences is like elementary school kids. I always go into third, fourth graders every year at our local school. Love talking to them about space, because they just eat it up. They're so curious, and they really have so many good questions, like the spaceship firing the laser. Really, really good questions. All of them could be astrophysicists. I mean, a little bit more practical advice is you do need to know a fair bit of math, and you know, take your physics classes and do well in school and all that. But I think all that, you know, you can kind of wing it, but it's the curiosity that's the basis for everything.
It's fascinating. I was wondering, I know that you're a writer as well, and you're educating people and talking to your kids about it. So it's creativity plays a role in it. You talked about curiosity. Do you consider yourself to be a creative person?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Outside of my professional life, I also do a lot of woodworking. That's a very different, but you know, equally satisfying creative endeavor. I like to make up my own plans and my own designs, which kind of work sometimes. Sometimes they need to be tweaked. So even though I don't actually work in a lab or work with instruments, that's a great way of, you know, expressing my creativity a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think it makes sense that you would want to and find enjoyment and value in actually putting your hands on something and shaping something versus the other stuff that I have absolutely no idea what you really do during the day. I think it was kind that you said that anybody could be an astrophysicist, but I'm confident that I could not be, Jeremy, but that's okay.
Well, any third grader could be.
Okay, there you go. What do you... Are the things that you wish that or would encourage people to think about more or look more into?
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime you read an article online that, you know, kind of interesting, you know, you clicked on it for whatever reason. Oh, black hole. That's some kind of interesting. I encourage you to then do another click, you know, either click on a link that's in the article, just go one step further. Because there's always either another part to the story or another piece of the background. This is the great blessing, but potential trap of Wikipedia, right? You know, we all talk about the Wikipedia rabbit hole, but that's, you know, that's science. You read one thing and it gets your interest, your curiosity up about another thing. So you go click on that other thing and then you go down that. And, you know, it takes you down this wonderful rabbit hole. Let's not forget, right? The real rabbit hole from Alice in Wonderland was a magical, magical rabbit hole. And we shouldn't be afraid of them.
I like it. One more question, Jeremy. What are aliens like?
Sorry, I'm not authorized to answer that.
Perfect. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people learn more about you? How can they engage with you and your work?
I guess Google, right? There's only one Jeremy Schnittman. All of my contact information is readily available for anyone who's curious. Please, the crackpots can stay away, but if you are curious, you have questions about black holes, you know, send me an email. I hope I can respond.
Excellent. Well, if you enjoyed as much as I did, show Jeremy your appreciation and share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Look up Jeremy Schnittman. It's Jeremy, J-E-R-E-M-Y, David, S-C-H-N-I-T-T-M-A-N. And educate yourself a little bit more about this fascinating field and the work that Jeremy is doing, because it is all very fascinating, obviously. I don't even think we scratched the surface, but so much more to learn, and I really appreciate your time. Thanks again, Jeremy.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, George.
Till next time, remember, do your part by doing your best.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.